Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zapallo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzapallo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Tonight's guest, Dan Kamen, internationally known Pittsburgh-based performer. Welcome to Berg Vivant. It is so great to be here chatting with you.
Thank you. An absolute pleasure.
So we're going to start off with a local headline from one of our fine Pittsburgh media publications. That headline is, Equality Tops Pittsburgh Protesters' Agenda, Women's Rights Group Abandons Their Plan to Go Topless. And this, of course, was an event organized by GoTopless.org, whose motto is Free Your Breasts, Free Your Mind. And during this event, a group of about half dozen protesters and three semi-nude women who were covered with strategically placed duct tape, marched from the Wyndham Grand Hotel to the fountain at Point State Park on Sunday afternoon. So, somehow or another, on Berg Vivant, we always end up talking about nudity. And as somebody who has such control over their own body to have, you know,
and my own nudity, I might add.
Well, good. I'm glad.
And I'm glad we're keeping abreast of the issues. This is so unexpected that we're already on such an intimate level.
We don't waste any time here on BV. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I was very amused by the newspaper article that I read. I'm an avid reader of the Post-Gazette, and I thought it was very funny how they're just so good-spirited that they didn't mind that there's a local ordinance, they had to cover themselves up, and they're making a point.
And that was the respectful thing, too, because I think, you know, everybody thought, well, there's going to be all of these topless women downtown, you know, but they were very respectful about it. You know, they had the pasties and things, so nobody was breaking the law. So I think it was a very good demonstration, very law-abiding. And, you know, I'm all for equality, and I think that was the point of this, that women should have just as equal rights as men to go topless. Now, I think maybe it's more of an issue of, you know, what constitutes illegal nudity or indecent exposure, but, you know, all for equality. So I think it's a larger issue. I don't know kind of how I really feel about it, but
I was struck by the fact that it was juxtaposed with the new march on Washington commemorating the 1963 march, because social change comes slowly, and you know, you can say it's the one is trivial next to the other, but the articles that have followed up on the 1963 march have made it clear. And Trayvon Martin, you know, we're still in the grip of a social change that's been happening here since the Civil War, and we're full of turmoil about it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I thought I was fascinated. I'm proud to say that one of the contributors to the March article was somebody who I've known for a long time, Paul Schrading, who was a minister here at UACM in Oakland for a long time. And Paul was at the 1963 march.
Wow.
And I just called Paul because I was trying to track down one of my first students when I first started teaching after graduating from college and beginning my mime career, because at first it was just mime that I wanted to do. And one of my first students was another minister's son, and I haven't heard from him really. Of course, mimes, you know, are a detested breed, and so there's always the possibility they can be waylaid by any number of people anywhere in the world and never be heard of again. And who could blame those people, really? And but I hadn't heard from this guy, and I wanted to catch up with him. And so I talked to Paul, and he gave me the contact information about this fellow who's currently an electrician in Connecticut.
And this all came about because of the March for Toplessness in Pittsburgh, I guess.
Well, there you are. If it wasn't for those topless women, I'd never have found this fellow again.
And, you know, I think the naysayers always exaggerate. I mean, they're picturing, like, if this were made legal, there'd just be topless women everywhere. And that's not the case. Because, I mean, you don't see topless men everywhere. Men don't go to work shirtless. I mean, unless they're, like, a Chippendale. But they probably don't even drive to work like that. They probably, you know, they're not driving down the highway, you know, in just a bow tie, you know, so it would be controlled, I think, even if it did become legit. I don't think it would be an issue. I don't. So,
well, you know, you just look at, as you can see, being in my home, it's filled with posters from the silent film era. And if you look at the bathing suits in the silent film era, you know, a glimpse of stocking was
rather one, shocking.
What's the actual line? A glimpse of
in olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. But now, Lord knows.
And it's true. And women wore tights. They did not reveal their bare legs in swimming suits. Men didn't go topless either. They wore leotard kind of things with shorts on the bottom or tights. And these things are kind of arbitrary. What's revealed and when is a fascinating kind of barometer of where we are, where every culture is. Because 300 years ago, women were really exposing most of their breasts in the fashions. And suddenly, in the Victorian era, there was no décolletage. And then I still remember when the controversial Rudi Gernreich bathing suit came out, which was essentially a topless bathing suit, and you know, suddenly in France is getting publicity because, you know, there are topless beaches. You know, it all goes into the cultural soup, and ultimately in the media, sells magazines and newspapers.
Now, undoubtedly, we talked a bit about just fashion back in the silent era. Without a doubt, silent film has had a great influence on your career. Is this true?
Film generally has had a big influence on my career. I was just a kid, and I saw the movie about Houdini that starred Tony Curtis when I was very young, when it came out. And I thought it was fascinating, and so fascinating that at the first opportunity, I started studying magic. I mean, I was this little nerdy kid who, you know, got books from the library, and a kid next to me did a magic trick, and I attached myself to him. Teach me. And by the time I was 12, I had begun my professional career. I was doing magic shows. That's the way I found to make a living. So if I hadn't seen that movie, that wouldn't have happened. Then I went to college because I did not want, I grew up in Miami, Florida, which was a rather bizarre place for anybody to grow up. It's still bizarre. I just have to point out that there's always been a crime show set in Miami.
This is true.
Yeah, if you think about it, there's always been a crime show. For a while, it went to Hawaii, but basically there's been an unbroken, and the reason is that there's always been a lot of crime. It's a resort place, and where magicians would perform if they were kind of at the top of their form were in these smoky nightclubs with, you know, some of which were kind of girly shows, burlesque houses. I watched, you know, I saw the posters for these places, and I dreamed, geez, maybe I could get to buy a tux like your nice tux, Brian, you know, be able to perform in one of those places. But instead, I got to perform in children's birthday parties, snot-nosed children who were obnoxious and had no interest in what I was trying to do. But I veered away from that, went to college here in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon to study something much more practical, industrial design. That's what I came up here and ended up studying. But midway through, they showed a movie, a Charlie Chaplin movie. And I had never seen a Charlie Chaplin movie. He was kind of persona non grata in America, in the America that I grew up in, because of the McCarthy era. He was really one of the victims of the McCarthy era because he was very left-wing. He was politically activist. So I'd never seen one. And when they showed one of his best, The Gold Rush from 1925. And it was accompanied on the piano by one of my classmates, Stephen Schwartz, who your listeners may know from a couple of shows he wrote, like Godspell and Wicked. Mm-hmm. But in those days, I was hiring him for $25 to play movies for the film club, which I was running. And the Gold Rush, I don't remember his score, but I sure remember everything about the movie because it simply was the best movie I'd ever seen, and I wanted to know how I could become a part of that world. Just as we're sitting here in front of a giant movie poster with an image of Charlie Chaplin in it, then we seem to be in the poster. I've, in a sense, I stepped into that world that night, and in one sense, I never left it because I wanted to, but I had a problem. They weren't making silent movies anymore. The Artist that came out last year is the exception that proves the rule.
I did want to ask you how you felt about that film.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, but there was no place to go with being a silent, you know, I was really lucky, though, because one of the teachers that had just been hired the same year I came there was a wonderful mime artist. And pardon me for becoming the scholar part of me, but mime is an odd word and an odd art form, simply because the other art forms have an unbroken history. Dance. There's always people dancing, and the sort of the shape changes, but you always call it dance. Music. You know, it could be bluegrass, it could be rap, it could be punk, it could be, you know, avant-garde classical, John Cage.
Definitive.
But it's all music, and everybody accepts that. Mime, going back as far as we go in history, as far as we know about, it gets real popular as a discrete art form. And by which I mean the essential idea that you're going to communicate ideas instead of talking about them or playing music, you're going to communicate ideas with the movements of your body. You're going to act out ideas. It gets really popular, and then people get really sick of it, and that keeps happening. And if you look at the 19th century, I don't know. But if you look at the 20th century, our century up until, you know, 2000, theater was the dominant theatrical art form of the early year of the 19th century and before, hundreds of years before. Silent movies started happening, and by the time Charlie Chaplin began making movies in 1914, they had become so popular that they basically, within the next 5 to 7 years, totally displaced theater as the cultural dominant art form. And instead of seeing theaters with 200-300 seats, like going to see something at Stephen Foster Memorial, or 500 seats, suddenly they could build theaters that were 3,000 seats.
Mm-hmm.
There were movie palaces. There used to be one in East Liberty called the Enright.
Oh, Pittsburgh had
3,000 seats, right. Some of the Stanley, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that the cultural overlords of Pittsburgh have retained the Stanley sign, that beautiful sign, because the word Stanley Photoplays is a forgotten artifact, both the Stanley, which was the original name of the theater when it opened in 1927, and the word photoplay, which, do you know what the word photoplay means, Brian?
I guess moving picture, a play with photos.
Most people I ask don't even make that connection, photoplays, but when pictures first started happening, moving, people saw them as photograph plays, and the early word for it, they always called them movies, but right away, and there was a magazine called Photoplay right away. They saw them as photoplays, and they kept calling them photoplays until sound came in, which is when people got tired of silent photoplays. They were never silent. There was always live musicians accompanying them, and even the smallest theater would have a pianist or a little theater organ or a trio. A theater, I have an ad from the Stanley, it's not from the Stanley, it's from the Grand, another theater that became the Warner, I think, downtown, and it says continuous showing from 1923, continuous showings 10 a.m. till midnight.
Wow.
And live music, and in the evening showings, it probably would have been a 25-piece orchestra accompanying the feature film, which would have changed twice a week in those days. But as soon as sound came in, they stopped calling them photoplays, and they started calling them talkies.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie industry thought, well, we'll make some silent films, as we've always done, but we'll also have some films that are where this new talking thing where it really is like a photograph play, and we'll have some of the singing, dancing musicals that people are crazy about. But the public said no. The public simply stopped going to silent films. Silent films were done within a year or two, and there were no silent films made after 1929 in America, except for one person kept the faith. And it was Charlie Chaplin, because his popularity was so great. He was still the top comedian star, certainly, in not only America, but the entire world. And he really regretted that coming of sound because it meant he was going to lose, as soon as he opened his mouth, he was going to lose 70% of his audience worldwide. So he hedged his bets by making silent sound compromise movies, somewhat along the lines of The Artist, except far better. So the public turned away from mime. And then suddenly the audience, the comedians, the generation that had grown up in silent films started to appear in the new medium, television, 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And people were buying televisions not because they thought it was a great new technology. They wanted to see that funny guy, Milton Berle, who wore crazy big straw hats like this and dressed as a dame sometimes. So they bought that little fuzzy image that we would laugh at today because it's practically like an iPod, you know, like, which is the little one? Yeah, the iPod.
Yeah, and the glass was so thick, it was almost like looking through a ship's window.
It was curved, it was all black and white, and it was snow, but you could see the person moving in your home, and you didn't have to pay anything. Mm-hmm. You paid one time, and then it was free. You just had to watch the commercials. And if you think about it, people don't think about this, but people didn't call silent movie actors mimes. They were just actors, but they happened to be silent. People didn't call Red Skelton, Jackie Gleason, Sid Caesar, the great TV clowns that sold television to the public. They didn't call them mimes. They called themselves pantomimists because about half their shows, a third to a half of their show, were silent sketches. Jackie Gleason had a character, Reginald Van Gleason III, never said a word. Red Skelton, Freddy the Freeloader. All had all the, because they grew up on silent films, and to them, the highest form of comedy was if you can make the audience laugh without talking. And so, you know, then suddenly people got tired of them. And about 10, 12 years, 15 years, the variety show, the day of the great variety show, ended. And so mime was again relegated to nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly this guy from France with a white makeup on his face, appearing by himself on a stage, created these astonishing physical illusions that he could walk against the wind and create objects that seemed very real, and he could tell stories where he played all the roles himself, and everybody flipped out, Marcel Marceau. Mm-hmm. And suddenly mime was hot again, and suddenly a bunch of Americans started doing it as well, and I was one of them. At a time when most people didn't even know Marceau's name, but they started to see Shields and Yarnell and so on. After about 10 years, everybody got sick of those people, and it seemed like, you know, we've seen it already, you know, enough with the wind, enough with the box closing in. Yeah. And when Marcel Marceau died just a few years ago, I heard one radio person say, this is one box he's not going to get out of. Rather cruel joke, but appropriate.
Yes, indeed.
And everybody got sick of mime. And so, you know, why did it happen? I think it's just trends, and people need some. It's why The Artist was such a refreshing change to people, because, you know, we forget that somebody can be, you know, why somebody like Jim Carrey appears, and he's funny like Jerry Lewis was funny. Mm. He's funny because of the faces he makes, and same thing with Steve Martin in his early days and Woody Allen. They all did all kinds of good physical gags, and then they stopped. It's harder to come up with the physical gags and keep them going.
Did it maybe get oversaturated, like too many poor imitators of mime that maybe kind of oversaturated the mime market? I don't know.
Well,
what
you could say, are we oversaturated with Meg Ryan? We, you know, she got older, but she's still great looking. But we, you know, things have a lifespan. You know, the public wants a new toy, and you know, you have your oldies and your mm-hmm. classics, but you know, for a lot of people, they want to. What's next? Raiders of the Lost Ark was good, Stephen. What's your new movie? Let's see that. We've already seen
it. We need Castle of the Crystal Skull or whatever it was. I don't know. It was nice to see Indiana Jones.
Well, we want
to
see his new stuff, and you know, because he's kept up, you know, he's maintained it. But he's artists who command the public's attention are the exception, and that's why a career like that of Charlie Chaplin, who was my touchstone for getting into the career I've had, is so extraordinary, because he made films into the 1960s.
And that's, I think, something that really set him apart from some of his peers in silent film. I can't think of another one that really had the longevity that Chaplin did in the same way.
Laurel and Hardy did.
Okay, there you go.
You know, they kept making films.
And they did
films.
Start in silence.
They absolutely started. Yep. They both started. They started in the same time he did, really. They started in the teens. But they didn't catch on until they teamed up. They weren't a team until the late 20s. About 26, 27, they started making movies together. And they very quickly figured out who they were, who they became in relation to each other. Yeah. Hardy had always played the bad guy. He played the heavy. And Stan played this sort of frenetic guy just jumping all around. And suddenly they became like children. And Stan became, somebody said, two minds without a single thought.
It's entertaining.
But they were like a couple of siblings, a couple of kids. They were, and to this day, you know, if somebody see, I show them to a young girl who had, I guess she was a daughter of a friend of mine. She was about 12. She had never seen them before. And she was instantly, utterly charmed and in hysterics about this, so much so that she downloaded the songs from the video and she plays them. And, you know, so some things have staying power. W.C. Fields was a silent movie star, but not a really big one. But in sound, he became huge until the end of his life in the early 40s.
And he started in vaudeville.
Absolutely.
He was a juggler, right?
He was a juggler. He was considered the greatest juggler in the world. And you see fragments of it because he always would work these old juggling routines into his films. And he took juggling way beyond what anybody had done before, you know, with routines with where he was playing pool. And so he would do these astonishing things where he would hit the cue ball, it would bounce off a cushion, hit him on the forehead, you know, or it would bounce off and he'd kick it up with the side of his foot, and it would get back on the table again. And I mean, just really wonder. And the great thing is, we see these routines in certain of his films. He kept on working them in whenever he could. And we also, in all of his performances, we see the mastery of physical motion that feel. He was as much of a great mime, in my view, as Charlie Chaplin, Laurel and Hardy. They were all great mimes. And some of them, there was this very rare period in the 30s where you got a mix of physical great mime as well as great verbal comedy. With Chaplin, you didn't get so much great verbal comedy. It was mostly, even in his sound films, the highlights are what he does, not what he says.
Looking at your career and the books that you have written, it seems that Chaplin, above all, really resonates with you the most. What is it what was Chaplin's magic that really kind of set him apart from everybody else for you?
When I saw The Gold Rush, I was so into that film, as I said, that I walked out of it into a different life. I was I had never seen a film that was, first of all, funny, but when that's what a comedy is, when a comedian makes you laugh, that's his job, and that's enough. But this film was much more than funny. It was also about real serious stuff. The Gold Rush is based on, partially on, it puts two things together, the actual Alaskan Gold Rush of the 1890s and the Donner Party expedition of, they weren't gold prospectors, they were just pioneers going west, mm-hmm. but they got snowbound.
Right.
And to survive in the winter in the Sierra Nevada mountains, they eventually ate their shoes and each other.
And off the bat, doesn't strike me as a comedy.
You know, and the scenes of cannibalism or near cannibalism in the Gold Rush are some of the marvels of all cinema history, because he found a way to make it funny. He's stranded with his huge bear of a cabin mate, and they then have nothing to eat, and we watch them day after day, and eventually the guy starts to go Charlie turns into a giant chicken in front of our eyes. It's a simple special effect, but because of Chaplin's mastery of mime, he doesn't just look like a chicken, he really moves
he
like a chicken,
it.
And Niagara picks up his, you know, pulls his knife out and starts chasing him around. And, you know, so we get, and then later in the film, you know, not much later, actually it's before that scene, they've eaten his shoe, they've eaten one of his shoes, and it becomes this gourmet. It becomes funny because he's treating it not like a shoe, not like a boiled shoe they're eating to eat something, but he bastes it and he twirls the laces, like he forces us to see through his physical way of handling the shoe how a shoe is like a gourmet meal to a starving man. He's very specific. The shoelaces are spaghetti, and the nail is like a wishbone that he extends to the other person to break.
The specificity.
Yeah, well, he forces us to see his inner world. And that was Chaplin's genius, is we know what he's thinking all the time. But it wasn't just that. There's also a romantic plot in The Gold Rush where he, when he finally gets to the Gold Rush town, there's a dance hall girl that he falls in love with instantly. And the romance between them is very, very poignant and heartbreaking and sweet. And all of this is silent. And all of this is done by a performer who sometimes looks as much like a dancer or a marionette than a human being. Because the movements are so stylized, and yet you don't think of that when you're watching
it.
You simply think, you're simply drawn into the story. And I had never seen anything that put so many of those elements together, and I certainly didn't think that it took me writing two books to recognize, to start to pick apart what are these things that have made these films resonate with people. We're approaching the 100th anniversary of his first films, and even the first films still can make audiences laugh. And what was he onto? That's what I wrote books to find out for myself, and I found out for myself in the process of becoming a performer who had to make up my own comedy material and see what worked and see what didn't and see the structures and study other people, you know. And so I've been a performer, but also I return to those films like you would return to a well and drink deeply of the source of your inspiration.
Very good. Very good. In fact, cheers to that.
I'll drink to that as well.
And one of the books, 1984, Charlie Chaplin's one-man show, correct? This actually led to you working on the Richard Attenborough film, Chaplin.
Very directly. I had the publisher send it to Robert, to the production, and Richard Attenborough just handed it to Robert. And my interest in Chaplin, I wrote a book, I did something very stupid. My friends would get so bored with my talking about Chaplin, running a movie and wanting to share my insights, that eventually I realized, because I'm bookish, and I went to the library to find the secrets of his work in the many, many books, in the hundreds of books that have been written about him, and I couldn't find anything that I wanted to read about. Well, the rags to riches story and the scandals, that was all interesting. What I wanted to know is, how did he come up with that thing with the shoe and with the dancing with the rolls and the Gold Rush and, you know, things that look like magic tricks quite often, like the dancing with the rolls where he makes the rolls look like little feet. It's like a magic trick because suddenly he becomes, it's like the forks are two little spindly legs and the shoes are way oversized, the rolls are way oversized shoes, and his head is a giant head. He's made a little puppet replica of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that replica does a dance that's very much like a female can-can dancer, a kind of a vaudeville dancer, and which charms utterly the dance hall girls that he thinks are watching. It's actually a dream. They're not watching at all. But so they're not there to fall in love with him, but we fall in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like a magic trick. You know, I wanted to know. So I wrote a book about the very technical aspects of Charlie Chaplin's films. What's he doing with his wrists and his shoulders? How are his gags put together? What are the common thing that links his gags together and his films together that give them that satisfying sense that you're not just seeing, you can look at any Chaplin film and feel that you're watching an epic that unfolds over all of his films,
mm-hmm.
because it is like one big, long, continuing saga of that character. And even when he didn't wear the makeup, you see that character still in him.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a book guaranteed to sell maybe 4 copies. Because who's going to read a book like that? Well,
and this is the stupid thing that you did.
That's so stupid. But it got published, and one of the 4 people was Robert Downey, who, when he read it, it had just come out in paperback, and he called me right here in Pittsburgh and said, you know, I think you may be the only person who can help me pull this off, because it read like a training manual for him. I'm talking about what's he doing when he walks?
What was it like getting that call? Were you like, okay, come off it, who is this really? Or
it was a jaw-dropping moment, and at the same time, I knew what he was talking about, and it's Hollywood, so I figured there'd be lots of experts. He'll be surrounded by an entourage and experts, and everybody will know more than me. But he read the book, and he recognized. He had been studying already for a year, reading everything he could on Chaplin. And he within a couple of weeks, he flew to Pittsburgh, and I was doing a show down in Oakland at the time on behalf of the Three Rivers Shakespeare Festival, but it wasn't a Shakespeare show. It was my latest solo show. And Robert came to see it first day he came in, and then we started the job of turning him into Charlie Chaplin. The first thing he said to me is, "I want you to tell me how to hold my fork," you know, because he recognized that to play Charlie Chaplin would be like they made a film about Enrico Caruso, and they asked you, Brian, to play Caruso. And by the way, no dubbing. You have to sing the voice as well, because there's no way to fake what Charlie Chaplin's art was. His art was the way he moved his body, and you can see it in newsreel footage of him at parties. He always moved in this extremely precise, choreographed-looking way. It's a pleasure to watch him move, and it's one of the pleasures of his films. It's one of the abiding pleasures of his films is he's simply one of the best movers. And has a, like Fred Astaire, there's a mesmerizing quality even when Fred Astaire is not dancing, when he's just talking, but he's sort of on the tips of his toes, and you know, you can see that physicality about him, and that way that all experience is being transformed into his physical self. And that's very true about Chaplin. So if it wasn't for writing that book that was so foolish to do, I would never have done anything in Hollywood, and it was a great privilege. When I got out there, I found, of course, that there was nobody who knew anything about why they brought me about. You know, I had to figure there'd be, you know, I'd be just standing in line with a bunch of other people telling him to, coaching him to, you know, because there's all kinds of choreographers and fight, but there's no name for what I did. That was one of the problems I had on that and other movies I did. There's fight choreographers, there's dance choreographers.
Chaplinologist.
There's no name for a physical comedy creator. There used to be a name in the silent film era. It was called Gag Man.
You know. That works.
Yes. Yeah. But the word choreographer didn't even exist. Fred Astaire's associate coined that. Hermes Pan coined the term choreographer. You know a lot about this. But there wasn't a word, and so we had to come up with words. You know, to for my credit, there was a considerable wrangling about how to label what I did for the film.
How about like a chaplain, like a religious post, like a military, a chaplain? I'm a chaplain. I'll teach you how to move like.
Good idea. Well, as a matter of fact, the first idea they came up with was chaplain consultant. I said, that's not very specific.
Well, how are you listed in the credits of the film?
I believe it was a chaplain choreography by me.
Very good.
Yeah, because I ended up not just training him to... We had a very interesting summit meeting at Robert's house where Richard Attenborough and came for dinner along with his assistant and Robert and I, and that's when Robert introduced me to Richard Attenborough and told him he would like me to be hired. And I said I had the temerity to say to Richard that I would have a problem coaching Robert to do the gags that are written into the script, because there are no gags written into the script. The comedy sequences were written by people who really didn't understand physical comedy and Chaplin's comedy. And Richard Attenborough didn't miss a beat. He said, of course, my dear boy, that's what you will help us with. And I ended up, in fact, creating several of the film's physical comedy sequences in Chaplin style, which is not something I would have chosen to do. I would have said, let's just do what he did.
Yeah.
But because of the film, everything got compressed and put out of context. And I ended up creating out of whole cloth several of the film's comedy sequences. So it's, you know, rather like, you know, rewriting Shakespeare. Thank you. In fact, there's a famous film credit, probably the most famous in history. The 1936 production of Midsummer Night's Dream has a credit for additional dialogue.
How dare they?
Exactly.
Well, that made old William turn in his grave, I'm sure.
But it was a great privilege to, you know, after all Chaplin had given to me, to be able to return the favor by helping to shape the portrait of him a little bit in that film. And of course Robert did such a wonderful job and was even nominated for an Oscar, so it was quite an amazing full circle in my life, from being inspired to go to the stage and then learning things from the stage that I could bring back to that film.
Did you go to the Oscars?
No, I didn't go to that Oscars.
Well, surely they invited you.
No, they didn't invite me. I was just way down on the crew list. Actually, it was a strange experience pecking order wise, because everybody behind the scenes you see was quite famous. The cinematographer of that movie was Ingmar Bergman's cinematographer. The guy who was the set designer did the Harry Potter sets a few years later. All these people were top of their field. And I was Mr. Nobody from nowhere, except that I happened to know this certain stuff about Charlie Chaplin. So I kind of was skipped to the head of the class, but I didn't have a department like they did. They all had their own trailers and departments and spaces to work. So I was hanging out with Robert in his trailer.
Did Robert Downey Jr. call you for Iron Man?
He did not. He did not. But I've just been so pleased to see the way his career has. I mean, it seemed like he was really going to self-destruct for a while there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just has soared, literally, in Iron Man. And he has such a wonderful way. He's such a brilliant, instinctive actor. And the challenge for him making the Chaplin movie was that he couldn't do it on instinct alone. He knew he needed some very specific physical skills. With Robert's a typical late 20th century guy, mm-hmm. and he moves. If he would sit down, and he would be kind of like this. Chaplin would sit down. It'd be
a performance.
there's that dance-like, precision about his work, and to get that. Robert worked. We worked for months before the film started to essentially train him to change his posture. Chaplin's posture is very regal. It's one of the things that makes his character incongruously funny. He's this homeless bum in many of his films, but he holds himself like an aristocrat, and he's wearing decrepit aristocrat clothes. And that's the fundamental joke of his character, the tension that is established between wealth and poverty, which, as you know, mm-hmm. is an underlying theme of almost all of his films.
And a hot topic at that time, because it would have been right around the Great Depression.
Well, no, his films were started to be made during the roaring teens and the 20s,
yeah.
But it became very timely, and of course he exploited that in his Great Depression film, Modern Times, that you were talking about to me earlier, that has, the image of him winding through the machine. He's playing a factory worker. He's not unemployed at the beginning of the film. He's a factory worker, but inevitably he wrecks everything and gets unemployed and has to deal with the realities of life in the Great Depression. So he applied his character as a kind of litmus test to what was going on. And then it shows strikes. It shows somebody being shot by police and killed. It's a film that combined, as Chaplin's best films do, high comedy, low comedy, and social commentary.
Yes, yes. So the working on the Chaplin film with Robert Downey Jr. led to some other fun projects out on the other side of the country. Benny and June, one of them as well.
Yes, that was another film. The word got out in L.A. that Robert, who was already known to the movie industry, although not to the general public, as an undisciplined bad boy and a druggie, was pulling it off, that he was doing a great performance as Charlie Chaplin. And so some people realized he's got to have somebody working with him to do that.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, right?
So even before the Chaplin movie came out, I was pulled into a meeting by the director, producer of the movie Benny and June, and eventually Johnny Depp came to the meeting as well, and sort of the same thing happened. I said, well, these gags in the film they're not gags, as the film was originally written. And they said, well, Mr. Smart Guy, what would you do? And it's actually my best moment in Hollywood, Brian, because I gave them what became the ending of the movie, and they all looked at each other. Not Depp wasn't in the room at that point. They all looked at each other and nodded and said, "You're hired." So it was a wonderful moment. And in fact, I got great creative leeway to create virtually all that film's comedy scenes. And the ending that I gave them was the nature of the character he plays was somebody obsessed with kind of silent movie comedy. He thinks he's the reincarnation of Buster Keaton kind of thing.
Yeah.
And at the end, it's sort of he sort of faded away. And there wasn't the scene where he climbs the building to reveal himself in the mental hospital to June. And I said, you can't have that character without him having a climax like a silent movie actor. But it isn't a silent movie, so he has to fall and really hurt himself. And that's the moment that they all looked at each other, because it made sense to them, and it gave that character his completion. He was allowed to complete his arc somebody obsessed with silent movies, but he was living in the real world, as it were, the world of that movie, although it's kind of a fable type of movie. But it was very satisfying, and Depp was delightful to work with, as was Robert Downey.
Now, I read a story, and I wonder if this is true, that the coin trick he does in Pirates of the Caribbean, where he flips the coin through his fingers.
What happened at that first meeting was that Depp at that time was a chain smoker. And I took the cigarette out of his mouth and I pushed it up my nose. And he said, "Whoa, I have to learn how to do that." And I told him the same thing I tell everybody who wants to know the kind of magic that I learned to do as a kid. You see, I was mentored by, I tried to learn from books, but you know, nobody can learn totally from books. And in Miami was a very lively scene of magicians and criminals who hung out together. And so I was meeting people with names like Evil Eye Finkel. He was a real person.
I love it.
People who were card sharps, Damon Runyon-esque kind of creatures, kind of people. You know, these guys wouldn't do magic tricks. They just would.
No, Evil Eye Finkel cut you.
Evil Eye Finkel, these people would, like, you'd start dealing, and the top card wouldn't move. They'd turn it up, and they'd start dealing, and it would just stay there until they were ready for it. And uncanny skills. And I was attracted to that kind of magic. There's different kinds of magic. You can buy a little prop in the store and do a magic trick or a mental trick where you're thinking of numbers. I liked the mime kind of magic, things done with movement and without trick props, such as this. Your radio listeners aren't going to appreciate this, but I'm rolling the coin around my finger, and that's what I showed Johnny Depp and said, "Well, if you can learn to do this, then I'll show you anything you want." And 2 weeks later, when I was brought back out to begin rehearsing with him, he couldn't do it very well because this takes a long time to learn, but he could do it without just dropping it every time.
Well, did you start him on a big coin, a really big coin that might...
Everybody, I use a silver dollar because my hands are so big and I do this from the stage. I told him to use a half dollar and he did. And
like, now here's a dime, go.
Yeah, it's very hard to do because if you try with the other hand, you see, it jumps back here, which is so annoying for the radio.
You got me.
So in fact, what we did, because I wanted him to do real physical comedy kind of routines, real silent movie physical comedy routines, which meant that there was going to be no movie trickery, no stuntmen. He was going to really, the day he flipped in the park, he was really flipping. And we did it about 25 times. His ankle, he fell wrong on the fourth time. His ankle swelled up to twice his size. Everybody freaked out and said, "You want to go to the hospital?" He said, "Nah," and he just kept doing it because he didn't care. He's just very much, he's a very craftsman, which is why he looks different and has done all this interesting gallery of different performances, because he looks at it very technically. Mm-hmm. And he looked at magic that way. And we would use the hours we spent practicing, I got to take a smoke break. Can we do another magic? And so, you know, in fact, I came up to him during the shooting of the scene in the park and said, one of the other actors said, "You know, you're giving him too much feedback. You're in his face. Why don't you..." And so I walked up to Johnny and said, "Am I in your face too much?" He said, what are you talking about? "Do that thing with the card again. Would you?" You know, he didn't care. And so he learned a lot of magic. We used it as a break, really, to get a kind of airing out and relief from the routine he does, where he does, people, kids think Johnny Depp invented the role thing, because I copped that. I invented everything that he does in that movie, just about, except for the dance of the two bread rolls, which, of course, I copped from that first Charlie Chaplin movie, bringing us neatly full circle in our interview.
So, yeah, and I think that coin roll shows up in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Well, then he did it. Well, you know, it's a sort of animated effect, but I know, I wasn't on the shoot, but I know for a fact there's no, I'd be willing to bet any amount of money. There's nobody that would have come up with that except Depp, because he's been doing it ever since. And so that was a great moment when I saw that he had brought it into it. I was going to say about the roll dance, we needed breaks, magic breaks, and he needed smoke breaks, because I would say for the 30 seconds he does that in the movie, we probably put in 20 hours of practice.
Wow.
Because it just takes that long to learn that kind of stuff. So it looks like it's just happening by magic, like it does when Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd or Charlie Chaplin or W.C. Fields do their routines.
And there's another little bit of cinema that I have to commend you on. And this may, you know, compared to everything else in your illustrious career, maybe seem like, you know, something dusty and forgotten. But when I saw the film Mars Attacks years ago, and I remember where I saw it. I saw it at the Bijou Theater in Harrisburg, right outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And it had been running for a while. And you'll love this too, because this was an old theater that operated like an old theater. They showed an old newsreel before the film, and then the curtain or the screen lifted up, and then there was a live ballet dancer, and then they showed the movie, and the movie was Mars Attacks, and I saw it with my cousin. And the most
there was a live ballet dancer before the movie?
Before Mars Attacks, yes.
What was that about?
They just provided this
entertainment.
Sort of a nod to having, you know, maybe live music during silent films, but they showed an old newsreel from years ago, like of the war and things. It was fantastic. I loved it. And then Mars Attacks, you know, which at that point was a little jarring after you saw somebody dance the Nutcracker. But, you know, even on top of all the explosions and the celebrities and the ridiculous stuff that went on in the movie, the most memorable thing for me was the robot woman walk, or the alien girl walk, which is another thing I found out that you were responsible for.
Well, it's interesting. It's my great distinction to have contributed to Tim Burton's one and only flop. That film was a resounding flop.
I think there have been others.
But none is quite as resounding as that one. And yet, movies have such a potency. They are so much our art form that I just got an email last week from a woman who said that she, I don't know if it's a girl or a woman, she said she's been obsessed for many years with the performance of the Mars Girl, and she somehow found out that I was responsible for training her. And in fact, as you probably know, the Mars Girl is the only Martian in the film that isn't just a computer animation. She's the only live actor who appears as a Martian in the film. Everything else was
cartoon. And it's a robot suit. It's supposed to be a Martian in a robot suit, or a Martian controlling a robot suit,
I think. Martian is inside, kind of the facade of a giant Barbie doll on steroids, yes. And but the woman was an actress named Lisa Marie, and she did a wonderful job. So it was wonderful to work with Tim Burton. Everybody said, would ask me when I was came back from that, is he really weird? Is his movies are so? Nah, he's an artist. He's a sketch artist. He would show you his ideas by drawing a little quick sketch and handing it to you. And everybody was, he's a very calm guy, and everybody was very. The movie wasn't financially successful, at least initially, but everybody was so pleased to work with him, and I got the great privilege of watching Jack Nicholson and Rod Steiger. Watching Jack Nicholson play, and I was the only person in the studio, and because of my Lisa Marie was at that time Tim Burton's love interest, and so I had a sort of privileged status as her movement coach, so I got to be in the studio when they cleared it for Jack Nicholson scenes, and watching him play scenes, I can tell you, which read on the page inertly, was like watching a trick archery player hit the bullseye from all, you know, between the legs, over the shoulder, with a mirror. Every time, his performance was immaculate. On screen, I don't think it looked that great because the script is weak. It's you know, but then again, that film has its fans too. I made a film years ago that came out of the Romero world. George Romero wrote the film Creepshow 2.
Yes, that's
neat. And before these other films happened, I played the wooden Indian in
that
film,
right,
who came to life. And my daughter was on the set. It was shot partially in Arizona, and she had never seen a horror movie, but she was on the set. And we were in the garage-like creature shop. And, you know, seeing creatures of a movie in a shop like going in, is like going into a costume shop. They're not scary.
Yeah.
But the movie came out, and she was at that time about 11. And she said, "Well, Dad, I know I've never seen a horror movie, but you're in this one. I have to see it." And all through the movie, I'm whispering to her. We saw it at the South Hills Village multiplex. I'm whispering to her, "You know, Hester, you were in the shop. Remember, this is not real, you know." And she said, yeah, okay, Dad. And at the end of it, she turned to me and said, "Well, Dad, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but that's the worst movie I've ever seen." And yet, somebody interviewed me for a Danish website devoted to Stephen King, where they're doing a big section on, you know, I mean, movies just have such power, and they're going to resonate with somebody.
Do you go to any of the conventions for, like, the horror conventions?
I never have. People have suggested that, and they said, you know, you can bring a stack of photos and sell them to people. That's what all these people who are in these schlock horror movies do. And I just can't bear selling somebody my autograph for $10. Although it may come to that if people keep hating minds.
Well, you know, you've got Hollywood, Johnny Depp, you've got Miami, Evil Eye Finkel. What attracts you to Pittsburgh?
When I started my career, mime, you have to realize, it wasn't the fad yet. This was the late 60s, and mime was just starting to begin. Americans were starting to do it, like me. I was a part of a kind of second generation of American mimes. First generation could not make much headway because Marceau had all the spotlight. And he would be on Ed Sullivan and so on. There was no room for anybody else, really. Second generation, you know, people like Shields and Yarnell and other American mimes started to change the form. The group Moominshot, some of your listeners will remember, they'd appear on Sesame Street.
The Muppet Show, I remember.
Giant slinkies, and you don't know whether they're upside down in the costume, and that those great masks with clay, and were they moving them as they're doing a skit with each other. Mm-hmm. And so the form began to expand, and when I realized that I wanted to actually pursue this, that I thought I had a voice to speak in this language, this silent language, I realized that no matter where I lived, I would be moving around. I would be traveling to do my shows. I couldn't be in one place and make a career there. And Pittsburgh seemed sort of central. And also Pittsburgh, you know, when I went to school here in the 60s, I could draw on my windowsill in the dorm every morning. It was polluted. And it was a steel town in those days. And I figured if I could get these steel hunks, you know, to respond to what I'm doing, if I can get them to understand it, because it seems so esoteric. Oh, mime, you know,
they needed a mime.
Well, if I could get them to understand it, I figured anybody would. Yeah. And that proved to be a kind of good decision. And I started doing shows in schools around here and then going out afield. Then everybody started hating mime. So the real problem for me...
You went really, underground.
Well, it really happened after those movies came out, because those were in the early 90s. And by that time, mime has pretty much used up the public's tolerance, and people, you know, the white face had become a kind of joke on Saturday Night Live, and, you know, people, you know, if you shoot a mime, do you use a silencer? Somebody gave me a birthday card once that said, if a mime falls in the park, and then you open it up and it says, does anybody care?
No. Ah, twist.
In the forest, I mean, if a mime falls in the forest, does anybody care? Do a little edit cut there.
Well, no, I got it. It works on both levels. It's all right.
But by that time, I was already talking in most of my shows, and I had begun something that's become something I do now a lot, which is I had begun, in a sense, turning silent movies on their head. Silent movies were always accompanied by live music and big groups of musicians, almost symphonic size, in large movie palaces. I started accompanying symphony orchestras with physical action in shows that I called comedy concertos. And Pittsburgh Symphony began hiring me. Can you do something to keep the kids' attention while we're, you know, playing our music? Because they climb in the walls.
You're not fiddlesticks, are you?
I am not fiddlesticks. They don't hire me anymore because they have fiddlesticks.
Oh,
fiddlesticks, geez. You know, got me out of a job.
Jail with that guy.
But other symphonies started calling. You know, the word started getting around, and I started promoting it. And I realized I really like this thing of, you know, essentially it's a kind of humor that was mined most successfully by Victor Borge.
And
Danny Kaye, comedy and classical music in the Marx Brothers. You know, it's a natural combination, lowbrow humor and highbrow music. It makes everybody, it demystifies it, it takes away the formality and the pretension. And for kids, I become a visual gateway into what's happening in the music. Because my shows are not just they play music and I do something unrelated. My shows, what I came up with for the Comedy Concertos concept is that my shows are all about symphony concerts that go horribly wrong. So, for example, the conductor announces we're going to have the guest artist, this mime physical comedian, Mr. Dan Kamen. But I'm not there. And he looks at the other side, Mr. Dan Kamen. And then he turns to the audience and says, well, this is a little embarrassing. He doesn't seem to be here. And to tell you the truth, I'm a little bit worried because he didn't come to rehearsal either. And when I called him on the phone, I couldn't tell if he was there because, of course, mimes don't talk. Well, we're going to go on anyway and hope if he's anywhere in the tri-state area. He shows up. I just did this in March, this past March, with Walter Morales and the Edgewood Symphony in the JCC in Squirrel Hill, since the Pittsburgh Symphony never hires me anymore. Thank you very much.
Maybe they will after this.
Maybe they will. Yeah. I just also did this same show with the conductor speaking Chinese in June in Hangzhou, China. I do it all over the world. I'm slated to go to Montreal and do the show in French next year because the conductor speaks all the lines. When I finally show up, he says, well, you didn't show up. What do you expect us to do? And I grab the baton and wrestle with him over it. And he pulls it away and says, no, I'm the conductor and you're the mime. If you want to play tug of war, do it with somebody from the audience. And I get a kid up, they play Benjamin Britten's Simple Symphony, the finale, and I do a tug of war. So the whole show becomes a struggle for power, so it moves into the present tense.
And it works in every language.
And
it's physical comedy.
And the reason it works, really, Brian, since we're having a kind of technical structural discussion today about why comedy works, what goes, is because the audience is asking the question they do when they're watching a good movie or reading a good book, which is, what's going to happen next? When you listen to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, if you're a kid who's 5 years old, you're not asking what's going to happen next. You're thinking, pretty.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? What's my finger doing? You know, you're getting distracted. I'm essentially giving the silent movie a visual score, just like during the era of silent movies, the pit orchestras gave the silent movie and a musical score.
It's a brilliant comedic setup, too, because in a way, almost, the symphony becomes the straight man.
They do, and I get everybody into the act. The musicians do not escape, not only the conductor.
No matter how badly they want to.
By the end of that show, I become the conductor. The conductor becomes a mime in a white face mask I provide, and the whole orchestra turns into mimes. So everything gets turned on its head. And that's the nature of comedy, is a broken world is made right again.
I love it. So is this what pretty much keeping you busy then these days, is traveling, doing your,
yes,
doing your show?
Well, I'm a Pittsburgher. I live here. I do shows in the public schools and private schools through an organization called Gateway to the Arts, a wonderful organization.
Yes, of course.
Occasionally I'll do first night performances. I just did one at the August Wilson Center a couple of years ago. But most of my shows are out of town, and so I'm a Pittsburgh guy who's exporting culture created in Pittsburgh to the rest of the world, and that's the greatest feeling in the world. And I'm a Pittsburgher now, and I've lived here for most of my life. And,
attaboy.
And you know, Carnegie Mellon, the secret of Carnegie Mellon as a brilliant school in the arts, is that it's a trade school like it was originally. Mm-hmm. We all of us who studied there learned to look at our art as craft. And that's what enabled me to make a leap from doing visual art to doing theatrical art, and to figure out what to do when the world changed under my feet, when people started hating mimes, and you know, where do you do it? Oh, you know, we learn to do the impossible all the time at CMU. That's why it's such a great school.
And you are, at this point, you're so incredibly varied in talent. You've got a lot of tricks up your sleeve. You know? So. And also, you know, your energy strikes me as that of a true vaudevillian, you know, a true performer. So let me ask you this. If you were in a situation like one of those old vaudeville manager's offices, you know, you're going for the audition, and he's in there, you know, bald, sweaty, you know, half-chewed cigar, and he's like, all right, kid, give me 2 minutes of your best stuff. What would that be? Out of anything you could do, what would that be? 2 minutes of absolute best material.
one of the things I love doing most, it's all about context. Magic works in almost any context. When I was 16 years old, there was a show that was the forerunner of what's the current biggest talent show? Is it Star Search or?
I think these days it's American Idol.
American Idol, of course.
America's Got Talent.
America's Got Talent of its day was called Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour. And I auditioned when they came to Florida to do two shows. And I did tricks with thimbles on my fingers. And I ended up doing them. They picked me for the show to be one of the contestants on the show. And I ended up doing it in an auditorium of 2,000 people.
Oh my God.
So nobody had any idea what I was doing. Of course, I didn't win. But it fascinated those people. I'd probably show them my thimble tricks. Because it's about context. One of the other things I like doing is doing theater where people don't expect it. If your listeners go online, they'll see me during the healthcare hearings in the Supreme Court. They'll see me in front of the Supreme Court the day of the healthcare hearings, walking, crossing the street with my transparent briefcase in extreme slow motion. And they'll watch all the media that turn away from the protesters that are yelling at each other, and swinging around to watch me. Across the street in slow motion, and people were trying to figure out which side I was representing and what's.
But was this a gig, or you were just doing it for laughs?
I was doing it as a public performance stunt. I call that character Mr. Slow-Mo. And one of my favorite performance stunts, because everything's out of context now. That's why symphony orchestra things, it's hard to find the audience, because you're looking at a thing by Handel that was done when people were riding on a boat, and you're looking at an overture from a ballet, but you don't see the ballet, and you're hearing an opera overture, but you don't hear the opera. Everything is out of context. Mm-hmm. So the challenge for me is to find the context in which things work. So one of my favorite things is to appear as the keynote speaker for a group that doesn't know I'm a performer. And for example, I'll go before a group and be introduced as a world-renowned stress management expert. But unfortunately, all my stress management tips backfire in increasingly humiliating ways. My glasses fall apart, and this thing I'm reading from starts to get demented and Freudian, and suddenly the lectern I'm speaking at collapses under me, and my clothes disintegrate, leaving me in big red polka dot boxer shorts. And until that moment, there are some people in the audience who are thinking, oh my God, this guy's having a really bad day. And so I love that performance space where people don't know it's a performance. When I appear on the street as my Mr. Slow-Mo character, nobody looks at me until I start moving into slow motion, even though I'm carrying the briefcase. Nobody gives it a second thought. I'm just dressed like this, like a businessman, but a businessman who, because of movement, it seems to have stepped out of the Twilight Zone. And so you'll see on the video on YouTube, it's called Mr. Slow-Mo Goes to Washington, capping on Mr. Smith, of course. You'll enjoy it. And you'll see how people do double takes, genuine double takes in real life as I do this. And I did it, I was doing a week of performances on behalf of Gallaudet University, which is the school for the deaf, the university for the deaf, an arts festival called QuestFest that comes out. They hired me to do a week of shows for deaf people, but also for hearing people, because of the way my work has that visual element to it. So the answer to what I would do is
ask for 10 more minutes.
Something that works in context. Mm-hmm. And that's really the challenge. Who am I? The question in my life and career has been, who am I in front of the Rotary Club? Who am I in front of the symphony? Who am I in front of that guy in his office with a cigar? Who am I in front of 2,000 elementary school kids in a gymnasium in a school? And the answer is a different person the answer is whatever works. Mm-hmm. And whatever it takes. Given the fact that, my overall underlying reason for being is really to play with people's heads and to delight them with the crafts of magic and mime and comedy, all through movement.
It's an excellent purpose. Absolutely, and we applaud it. Pittsburgh is so thankful to have you here. It's fantastic. So we always love it when you return, and hopefully we'll see you around, maybe with your transparent briefcase. And your most recent book, The Comedy of Charlie Chaplin, is currently available via Amazon, yes?
Oh, you can get it anywhere. And, mm-hmm. You can get it on Amazon and some of the, I think there's one or two circulating in the Pittsburgh Public Library system even. Yes.
Check it out. Or purchase it. Fantastic.
Well, you know, I had second thoughts. This was written 25 years after my first book. Uh-huh. And after 25 years, I just know more. And I'd had the experience of training. I never tried to be Charlie Chaplin myself, other than when I was first watching his films and fooling around in the dorm. But having had the experience of working on the movie, I had to go deeper. And with a great artist like Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Shakespeare, Beethoven, you don't exhaust them. They keep on changing as you change. You simply go deeper in the well.
And the world's leading Charlie Chaplin expert right here in good old Pittsburgh. Dan, it was so great to have chatting with you here.
Pleasure talking to you.
We'll do it again.
Thanks for coming by.
Oh, anytime. Thank you so much. In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvivant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvivant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.